to stand by such convictions against strong appetites, but we do not sympathize with wickedness, nor with any of the other blameworthy states. Is it, then, practical wisdom whose resistance is mastered? That is the strongest of all states. But this is absurd. The same man will be at once practically wise and incontinent, but no one would say that it is the part of a practically wise man to do willingly the basest acts. Besides, it has been shown before that the man of practical wisdom is one who will act, for he is a man concerned with the individual facts, and who has the other virtues. Second. Further, if continence involves having strong and bad appetites, the temperate man will not be continent, nor the continent man temperate. For a temperate man will have neither excessive nor bad appetites. But the continent man must. For if the appetites are good, the state of character that restrains us from following them is bad. So that not all continents will be good, while if they are weak and not bad, there is nothing admirable in resisting them. And if they are weak and bad, there is nothing great in resisting these either. Third. Further, if continence makes a man ready to stand by any and every opinion, it is bad, i.e., if it makes him stand even by a false opinion. And if incontinence makes a man apt to abandon any and every opinion, there will be a good incontinence, of which Sophocles Neoptolemus in the Philoctetes will be an instance. For he is to be praised for not standing by what Odysseus persuaded him to do, because he is pained at telling a lie. Fourth. Further, the sophistic argument presents a difficulty. The syllogism arising from men's wish to expose paradoxical results arising from an opponent's view, in order that they may be admired when they succeed, is one that puts us in a difficulty. For thought is bound fast when it will not rest because the conclusion does not satisfy it, and cannot advance because it cannot refute the argument. There is an argument from which it follows that folly coupled with incontinence is virtue. For a man does the opposite of what he judges, owing to incontinence, but judges what is good to be evil, and something that he should not do, and consequence, he will do what is good, and not what is evil. Fifth. Further, he who on conviction does and pursues and chooses what is pleasant would be thought to be better than one who does so as a result not of calculation, but of incontinence, for he is easier to cure, since he may be persuaded to change his mind. But to the incontinent man may be applied the proverb, "When water chokes, what is one to wash it down with?" If he had been persuaded of the rightness of what he does, he would have desisted when he was persuaded to change his mind. But now, he acts in spite of his being persuaded of something quite different. Sixth. Further, if incontinence and continence are concerned with any and every kind of object, who is it that is incontinent in the unqualified sense? No one has all the forms of incontinence, but we say some people are incontinent without qualification. 3. Of some such kind are the difficulties that arise. Some of these points must be refuted, and the others left in possession of the field, for the solution of the difficulty is the discovery of the truth. First, we must consider first, then, whether incontinent people act knowingly or not, and in what sense knowingly. Then second, with what sorts of object the incontinent and the continent man may be said to be concerned, i.e., whether with any and every pleasure and pain, or with certain determinate kinds, and whether the continent man and the man of endurance are the same or different. And similarly, with regard to the other matters germane to this inquiry. The starting point of our investigation is A. The question whether the continent man and the incontinent are differentiated by their objects or by their attitude, i.e., whether the incontinent man is incontinent simply by being concerned with such and such objects, or instead, by his attitude, or instead of that, by both these things. B. The second question is whether incontinence and continence are concerned with any and every object or not. The man who is incontinent in the unqualified sense is neither concerned with any and every object, but with precisely those with which the self-indulgent man is concerned. Nor is he characterized by being simply related to these, for then his state would be the same as self-indulgence, but by being related to them in a certain way. For the one is led on in accordance with his own choice, thinking that he ought always to pursue the present pleasure, while the other does not think so, but yet pursues it. First, as for the suggestion that it is true opinion and not knowledge against which we act incontinently, that makes no difference to the argument. For some people, when in a state of opinion, do not hesitate, but think they know exactly. If, then, the notion is that owing to their weak conviction, those who have opinion are more likely to act against their judgment than those who know, we answer that there need be no difference between knowledge and opinion in this respect. For some men are no less convinced of what they think than others of what they know, as is shown by the example of Heraclitus. But, A, since we use the word know in two senses, for both the man who has knowledge but is not using it, and he who is using it are said to know, it will make a difference whether, when a man does what he should not, he has the knowledge but is not exercising it, or is exercising it, for the latter seems strange, but not the former. B. Further, since there are two kinds of premises, there is nothing to prevent a man's having both premises and acting against his knowledge, provided that he is using only the universal premise and not the particular. For it is particular acts that have to be done. And there are also two kinds of universal term. One is predicable of the agent, the other of the object. E.g., dry food is good for every man, and I am a man, or such and such food is dry, but whether this food is such and such, of this the incontinent man either has not or is not exercising the knowledge. There will, then, be firstly an enormous difference between these manners of knowing, so that to know in one way when we act incontinently would not seem anything strange, while to know in the other way would be extraordinary. And further, C, the possession of knowledge in another sense than those just named is something that happens to men, for within the case of having knowledge but not using it, we see a difference of state, admitting of the possibility of having knowledge in a sense and yet not having it, as in the instance of a man asleep, mad, or drunk. But now this is just the condition of men under the influence of passions. For outbursts of anger and sexual appetites and some other such passions, it is evident, actually alter our bodily condition, and in some men even produce fits of madness. It is plain, then, that incontinent people must be said to be in a similar condition to men asleep, mad, or drunk. The fact that men use the language that flows from knowledge proves nothing. For even men under the influence of these passions utter scientific proofs and verses of Empedocles, and those who have just begun to learn a science can string together its phrases, but do not yet know it, for it has to become part of themselves, and that takes time. So that we must suppose that the use of language by men in an incontinent state means no more than its utterance by actors on the stage. D. Again, we may also view the cause as follows with reference to the facts of human nature. The one opinion is universal, the other is concerned with the particular facts. And here we come to something within the sphere of perception, when a single opinion results from the two. The soul must in one type of case affirm the conclusion, while in the case of opinions concerned with production, it must immediately act. E.g., if everything sweet ought to be tasted, and this is sweet, in the sense of being one of the particular sweet things, the man who can act and is not prevented must at the same time actually act accordingly. When, then, the universal opinion is present in us forbidding us to taste, and there is also the opinion that everything sweet is pleasant, and that this is sweet, now this is the opinion that is active, and when appetite happens to be present in us, the one opinion bids us avoid the object, but appetite leads us towards it, for it can move each of our bodily parts. So that it turns out that a man behaves incontinently, under the influence, in a sense, of a rule and an opinion, and of one not contrary in itself, but only incidentally, for the appetite is contrary, not the opinion, to the right rule. It also follows that this is the reason why the lower animals are not incontinent, viz., because they have no universal judgment but only imagination and memory of particulars. The explanation of how the ignorance is dissolved and the incontinent man regains his knowledge is the same as in the case of the man drunk or asleep, and is not peculiar to this condition. We must go to the students of natural science for it. Now, the last premise, both being an opinion about a perceptible object and being what determines our actions, this a man either has not when he is in the state of passion, or has it in the sense in which having knowledge did not mean knowing but only talking, as a drunken man may utter the verses of Empedocles. And because the last term is not universal, nor equally an object of scientific knowledge with the universal term, the position that Socrates sought to establish actually seems to result. For it is not in the presence of what is thought to be knowledge proper that the affection of incontinence arises, nor is it this, that is, dragged about, as a result of the state of passion, but in that of perceptual knowledge. This must suffice as our answer to the question of action with and without knowledge, and how it is possible to behave incontinently with knowledge. 4. Second, we must next discuss whether there is anyone who is incontinent without qualification, or all men who are incontinent are so in a particular sense, and if there is, with what sort of objects he is concerned. That both continent persons and persons of endurance, and incontinent and soft persons are concerned with pleasures and pains, is evident. Now, of the things that produce pleasure, some are necessary, while others are worthy of choice in themselves, but admit of excess. The bodily causes of pleasure being necessary, by such I mean both those concerned with food and those concerned with sexual intercourse, i.e., the bodily matters with which we define self-indulgence and temperance as being concerned, while the others are not necessary but worthy of choice in themselves, e.g. victory, honour, wealth, and good and pleasant things of this sort. This being so, A. Those who go to excess with reference to the latter, contrary to the right rule which is in themselves, are not called incontinent simply, but incontinent with the qualification in respect of money, gain, honour, or anger. Not simply incontinent on the ground that they are different from incontinent people and are called incontinent by reason of a resemblance. Compare the case of Anthropos, man, who won a contest at the Olympic Games. In his case, the general definition of man differed little from the definition peculiar to him, but yet it was different. This is shown by the fact that incontinence, either without qualification or in respect of some particular bodily pleasure, is blamed not only as a fault but as a kind of vice, while none of the people who are incontinent in these other respects is so blamed. But B. Of the people who are incontinent with respect to bodily enjoyments, with which we say the temperate and the self-indulgent man are concerned, he who pursues the excesses of things pleasant and shuns those of things painful, of hunger and thirst and heat and cold, and all the objects of touch and taste, not by choice, but contrary to his choice and his judgment, is called incontinent, not with the qualification, in respect of this or that, e.g. of anger, but just simply. This is confirmed by the fact that men are called soft with regard to these pleasures, but not with regard to any of the others. And for this reason we group together the incontinent and the self-indulgent, the continent and the temperate man, but not any of these other types, because they are concerned somehow with the same pleasures and pains. But though these are concerned with the same objects, they are not similarly related to them, but some of them make a deliberate choice, while the others do not. This is why we should describe as self-indulgent rather the man who without appetite or with but a slight appetite pursues the excesses of pleasure and avoids moderate pains, than the man who does so because of his strong appetites. For what would the former do if he had in addition a vigorous appetite and a violent pain at the lack of the necessary objects? Now, of appetites and pleasures, some belong to the class of things generically noble and good. For some, pleasant things are by nature worthy of choice, while others are contrary to these and others are intermediate, to adopt our previous distinction, e.g. wealth, gain, victory, honour. And with reference to all objects, whether of this or of the intermediate kind, men are not blamed for being affected by them, for desiring and loving them, but for doing so in a certain way, i.e., for going to excess. This is why all those who, contrary to the rule, either are mastered by or pursue one of the objects which are naturally noble and good, e.g. those who busy themselves more than they ought about honour or about children and parents, are not wicked. For these too are good, and those who busy themselves about them are praised. But yet there is an excess even in them. If, like Niobe, one were to fight even against the gods, or were to be as much devoted to one's father as Satyrus, nicknamed the Filial, who was thought to be very silly on this point. There is no wickedness, then, with regard to these objects, for the reason named, viz., because each of them is by nature a thing worthy of choice for its own sake, yet excesses in respect of them are bad and to be avoided. Similarly, there is no incontinence with regard to them, for incontinence is not only to be avoided but is also a thing worthy of blame. But owing to a similarity in the state of feeling, people apply the name incontinence, adding in each case what it is in respect of, as we may describe as a bad doctor or a bad actor, one whom we should not call bad simply. As then, in this case we do not apply the term without qualification, because each of these conditions is no vice, but only analogous to it. So it is clear that in the other case also that alone must be taken to be incontinence and continence, which is concerned with the same objects as temperance and self-indulgence, but we apply the term to anger by virtue of a resemblance, and this is why we say with a qualification, incontinent in respect of anger, as we say incontinent in respect of honour or of gain. 5. First, some things are pleasant by nature, and of these, A. Some are so without qualification, and B. Others are so with reference to particular classes either of animals or of men, while second, others are not pleasant by nature, but A. Some of them become so by reason of injuries to the system, and B. Others by reason of acquired habits, and C. Others by reason of originally bad natures. This being so, it is possible with regard to each of the latter kinds to discover similar states of character to those recognized with regard to the former. I mean, A. The brutish states. As in the case of the female who, they say, rips open pregnant women and devours the infants, or of the things in which some of the tribes about the Black Sea that have gone savage are said to delight in, raw meat, or in human flesh, or in lending their children to one another to feast upon, or of the story told of Phalaris. These states are brutish, but B. Others arise as a result of disease, or in some cases of madness, as with the man who sacrificed and ate his mother, or with the slave who ate the liver of his fellow. And others are morbid states. C. Resulting from custom, e.g. the habit of plucking out the hair or of gnawing the nails, or even coals or earth. And in addition to these, pederasty. For these arise in some, by nature, and in others, as in those who have been the victims of lust from childhood, from habit. Now those in whom nature is the cause of such a state, no one would call incontinent, any more than one would apply the epithet to women because of the passive part they play in copulation, nor would one apply it to those who are in a morbid condition as a result of habit. To have these various types of habit is beyond the limits of vice, as brutishness is too. For a man who has them to master or be mastered by them is not simple, continence or incontinence, but that which is so by analogy, as the man who is in this condition in respect of fits of anger is to be called incontinent in respect of that feeling, but not incontinent simply. For every excessive state, whether of folly, of cowardice, of self-indulgence, or of bad temper, is either brutish or morbid. The man who is by nature apt to fear everything, even the squeak of a mouse, is cowardly with a brutish cowardice, while the man who feared a weasel did so in consequence of disease, and of foolish people, those who by nature are thoughtless and live by their senses alone are brutish, like some races of the distant barbarians, while those who are so as a result of disease, e.g. of epilepsy or of madness, are morbid. Of these characteristics, it is possible to have some only at times and not to be mastered by them. E.g. Phalaris may have restrained a desire to eat the flesh of a child or an appetite for unnatural sexual pleasure, but it is also possible to be mastered not merely to have the feelings. Thus, as the wickedness which is on the human level is called wickedness simply, while that which is not is called wickedness not simply but with the qualification brutish or morbid, in the same way it is plain that some incontinence is brutish and some morbid, while only that which corresponds to human self-indulgence is incontinence simply. That incontinence and continence, then, are concerned only with the same objects as self-indulgence and temperance, and that what is concerned with other objects is a type distinct from incontinence, and called incontinence by a metaphor and not simply, is plain. 6. That incontinence in respect of anger is less disgraceful than that in respect of the appetites is what we will now proceed to see. First, anger seems to listen to argument to some extent, but to mishear it, as do hasty servants, who run out before they have heard the whole of what one says, and then muddle the order, or as dogs bark, if there is but a knock at the door, before looking to see if it is a friend. So anger, by reason of the warmth and hastiness of its nature, though it hears, does not hear an order and springs to take revenge. For argument or imagination informs us that we have been insulted or slighted, and anger, reasoning as it were that anything like this must be fought against, boils up straightway, while appetite, if argument or perception merely says that an object is pleasant, springs to the enjoyment of it. Therefore, anger obeys the argument in a sense, but appetite does not. It is therefore more disgraceful. For the man who is incontinent in respect of anger is, in a sense, conquered by argument, while the other is conquered by appetite, and not by argument. Second, further, we pardon people more easily for following natural desires, since we pardon them more easily for following such appetites as are common to all men, and in so far as they are common. Now anger and bad temper are more natural than the appetites for excess, i.e., for unnecessary objects. Take, for instance, the man who defended himself on the charge of striking his father by saying, "Yes, but he struck his father, and he struck his, and," pointing to his child, "this boy will strike me when he is a man, it runs in the family." Or the man who, when he was being dragged along by his son, bade him stop at the doorway, since he himself had dragged his father only as far as that. Third. Further, those who are more given to plotting against others are more criminal. Now a passionate man is not given to plotting, nor is anger itself, it is open. But the nature of appetite is illustrated by what the poets call Aphrodite, guile-weaving daughter of Cyprus, and by Homer's words about her embroidered girdle. And the whisper of wooing is there, whose subtlety stealeth the wits of the wise, how prudent soe'er. Therefore, if this form of incontinence is more criminal and disgraceful than that in respect of anger, it is both incontinence without qualification and, in a sense, vice. Fourth. Further, no one commits wanton outrage with a feeling of pain, but everyone who acts in anger acts with pain, while the man who commits outrage acts with pleasure. If, then, those acts at which it is most just to be angry are more criminal than others, the incontinence which is due to appetite is the more criminal, for there is no wanton outrage involved in anger. Plainly, then, the incontinence concerned with appetite is more disgraceful than that concerned with anger, and continence and incontinence are concerned with bodily appetites and pleasures. But we must grasp the differences among the latter themselves. For, as has been said at the beginning, some are human and natural, both in kind and in magnitude, others are brutish, and others are due to organic injuries and diseases. Only with the first of these are temperance and self-indulgence concerned. This is why we call the lower animals neither temperate nor self-indulgent except by a metaphor. And only if some one race of animals exceeds another as a whole in wantonness, destructiveness, and omnivorous greed. These have no power of choice or calculation, but they are departures from the natural norm as, among men, madmen are. Now brutishness is a less evil than vice, though more alarming. For it is not that the better part has been perverted, as in man, they have no better part. Thus it is like comparing a lifeless thing with a living in respect of badness. For the badness of that which has no originative source of movement is always less hurtful, and reason is an originative source. Thus it is like comparing injustice, in the abstract, with an unjust man. Each is, in some sense, worse. For a bad man will do 10,000 times as much evil as a brute. 7. With regard to the pleasures and pains and appetites and aversions arising through touch and taste, to which both self-indulgence and temperance were formerly narrowed down, it's possible to be in such a state as to be defeated even by those of them which most people master, or to master even those by which most people are defeated. Among these possibilities, those relating to pleasures are incontinence and continence, those relating to pains, softness, and endurance. The state of most people is intermediate, even if they lean more towards the worst states. Now, since some pleasures are necessary while others are not, and are necessary up to a point while the excesses of them are not, nor the deficiencies, and this is equally true of appetites and pains, the man who pursues the excesses of things pleasant, or pursues to excess necessary objects, and does so by choice, for their own sake, and not at all for the sake of any result distinct from them, is self-indulgent. For such a man is of necessity unlikely to repent, and therefore incurable, since a man who cannot repent cannot be cured. The man who is deficient in his pursuit of them is the opposite of self-indulgent. The man who is intermediate is temperate. Similarly, there is the man who avoids bodily pains, not because he is defeated by them, but by choice. Of those who do not choose such acts, one kind of man is led to them as a result of the pleasure involved, another because he avoids the pain arising from the appetite, so that these types differ from one another. Now, anyone would think worse of a man with no appetite or with weak appetite were he to do something disgraceful, than if he did it under the influence of powerful appetite, and worse of him if he struck a blow not in anger than if he did it in anger. For what would he have done if he had been strongly affected? This is why the self-indulgent man is worse than the incontinent. Of the states named, then, the latter is rather a kind of softness. The former is self-indulgence. While to the incontinent man is opposed the continent, to the soft is opposed the man of endurance, for endurance consists in resisting, while continence consists in conquering. And resisting and conquering are different, as not being beaten is different from winning. This is why continence is also more worthy of choice than endurance. Now, the man who is defective in respect of resistance to the things which most men both resist and resist successfully is soft and effeminate. For effeminacy, too, is a kind of softness. Such a man trails his cloak to avoid the pain of lifting it, and plays the invalid without thinking himself wretched, though the man he imitates is a wretched man. The case is similar with regard to continence and incontinence. For if a man is defeated by violent and excessive pleasures or pains, there is nothing wonderful in that. Indeed, we are ready to pardon him if he has resisted, as Theodectes Philoctetes does when bitten by the snake, or Carcinus Cercian in the Alope, and as people who try to restrain their laughter burst out into a guffaw, as happened to Xenophontus. But it is surprising if a man is defeated by and cannot resist pleasures or pains which most men can hold out against, when this is not due to heredity or disease, like the softness that is hereditary with the kings of the Scythians, or that which distinguishes the female sex from the male. The lover of amusement, too, is thought to be self-indulgent, but is really soft. For amusement is a relaxation, since it is a rest from work, and the lover of amusement is one of the people who go to excess in this. Of incontinence, one kind is impetuosity, another weakness. For some men, after deliberating, fail, owing to their emotion, to stand by the conclusions of their deliberation. Others, because they have not deliberated, are led by their emotion, since some men, just as people who first tickle others are not tickled themselves, If they have first perceived and seen what is coming and have first roused themselves and their calculative faculty, are not defeated by their emotion, whether it be pleasant or painful. It is keen and excitable people that suffer especially from the impetuous form of incontinence. For the former, by reason of their quickness, and the latter by reason of the violence of their passions, do not await the argument, because they are apt to follow their imagination. 8. The self-indulgent man, as was said, is not apt to repent, for he stands by his choice. But the incontinent man is likely to repent. This is why the position is not, as it was expressed in the formulation of the problem, but the self-indulgent man is incurable, and the incontinent man curable. For wickedness is like a disease, such as dropsy or consumption, while incontinence is like epilepsy. The former is a permanent, the latter an intermittent badness. And generally, incontinence and vice are different in kind. Vice is unconscious of itself. Incontinence is not. Of incontinent men themselves, those who become temporarily beside themselves are better than those who have the rational principle but do not abide by it, since the latter are defeated by a weaker passion and do not act without previous deliberation like the others. For the incontinent man is like the people who get drunk quickly and on little wine, i.e., on less than most people. Evidently, then, incontinence is not vice, though perhaps it is so in a qualified sense. For incontinence is contrary to choice, while vice is in accordance with choice. Not but what they are similar in respect of the actions they lead to, as in the saying of Demodocus about the Milesians, "The Milesians are not without sense, but they do the things that senseless people do." So too incontinent people are not criminal, but they will do criminal acts. Now, since the incontinent man is apt to pursue, not on conviction, bodily pleasures that are excessive and contrary to the right rule, while the self-indulgent man is convinced because he is the sort of man to pursue them, it is on the contrary the former that is easily persuaded to change his mind, while the latter is not. For virtue and vice respectively preserve and destroy the first principle, and in actions the final cause is the first principle, as the hypotheses are in mathematics. Neither in that case is it argument that teaches the first principles, nor is it so here. Virtue, either natural or produced by habituation, is what teaches right opinion about the first principle. Such a man as this, then, is temperate. His contrary is the self-indulgent. But there is a sort of man who is carried away as a result of passion and contrary to the right rule. A man whom passion masters so that he does not act according to the right rule, but does not master to the extent of making him ready to believe that he ought to pursue such pleasures without reserve. This is the incontinent man, who is better than the self-indulgent man, and not bad without qualification, for the best thing in him, the first principle, is preserved. And contrary to him is another kind of man, he who abides by his convictions and is not carried away at least as a result of passion. It is evident from these considerations that the latter is a good state, and the former a bad one. 9. Is the man continent who abides by any and every rule and any and every choice, or the man who abides by the right choice? And is he incontinent who abandons any and every choice and any and every rule, or he who abandons the rule that is not false and the choice that is right? This is how we put it before in our statement of the problem. Or is it, incidentally, any and every choice but per se the true rule and the right choice by which the one abides and the other does not? If anyone chooses or pursues this for the sake of that, per se, he pursues and chooses the latter, but incidentally, the former. But when we speak without qualification, we mean what is per se. Therefore, in a sense, the one abides by, and the other abandons, any and every opinion, but without qualification, the true opinion. There are some who are apt to abide by their opinion, who are called strong-headed, viz., those who are hard to persuade in the first instance, and are not easily persuaded to change. These have in them something like the continent man, as the prodigal is in a way like the liberal man and the rash man like the confident man. But they are different in many respects. For it is to passion and appetite that the one will not yield, since on occasion the continent man will be easy to persuade, but it is to argument that the others refuse to yield, for they do form appetites, and many of them are led by their pleasures. Now the people who are strong-headed are the opinionated, the ignorant, and the boorish, the opinionated being influenced by pleasure and pain. For they delight in the victory they gain if they are not persuaded to change, and are pained if their decisions become null and void as decrees sometimes do. So that they are liker the incontinent than the continent man. But there are some who fail to abide by their resolutions, not as a result of incontinence, e.g. Neoptolemus in Sophocles' Philoctetes, yet it was for the sake of pleasure that he did not stand fast, but a noble pleasure, for telling the truth was noble to him, but he had been persuaded by Odysseus to tell the lie. For not everyone who does anything for the sake of pleasure is either self-indulgent or bad or incontinent, but he who does it for a disgraceful pleasure. Since there is also a sort of man who takes less delight than he should in bodily things, and does not abide by the rule, he who is intermediate between him and the incontinent man is the continent man. For the incontinent man fails to abide by the rule because he delights too much in them, and this man because he delights in them too little, while the continent man abides by the rule and does not change on either account. Now, if continence is good, both the contrary states must be bad, as they actually appear to be. But because the other extreme is seen in few people and seldom, as temperance is thought to be contrary only to self-indulgence, so is continence to incontinence. Since many names are applied analogically, it is by analogy that we have come to speak of the continence, the temperate man. For both the continent man and the temperate man are such as to do nothing contrary to the rule for the sake of the bodily pleasures, but the former has and the latter has not bad appetites, and the latter is such as not to feel pleasure contrary to the rule, while the former is such as to feel pleasure, but not to be led by it. And the incontinent and the self-indulgent man are also like another, they are different. But both pursue bodily pleasures, the latter, however, also thinking that he ought to do so, while the former does not think this. 10. Nor can the same man have practical wisdom and be incontinent. For it has been shown that a man is at the same time practically wise and good in respect of character. Further, a man has practical wisdom not by knowing only, but by being able to act. But the incontinent man is unable to act. There is, however, nothing to prevent a clever man from being incontinent. This is why it is sometimes actually thought that some people have practical wisdom but are incontinent, viz., because cleverness and practical wisdom differ in the way we have described in our first discussions, and are near together in respect of their reasoning, but differ in respect of their purpose. Nor yet is the incontinent man like the man who knows and is contemplating a truth, but like the man who is asleep or drunk. And he acts willingly, for he acts in a sense with knowledge both of what he does and of the end to which he does it, but is not wicked, since his purpose is good, so that he is half wicked, and he is not a criminal, for he does not act of malice aforethought. Of the two types of incontinent man, the one does not abide by the conclusions of his deliberation, while the excitable man does not deliberate at all. And thus the incontinent man, like a city which passes all the right decrees and has good laws, but makes no use of them, as in Anaxandrides' jesting remark, "The city willed it, that cares naught for laws, but the wicked man is like a city that uses its laws, but has wicked laws to use." Now incontinence and continence are concerned with that which is in excess of the state characteristic of most men. For the continent man abides by his resolutions more, and the incontinent man less than most men can. Of the forms of incontinence, that of excitable people is more curable than that of those who deliberate but do not abide by their decisions. And those who are incontinent through habituation are more curable than those in whom incontinence is innate. For it is easier to change a habit than to change one's nature. Even habit is hard to change just because it is like nature. As Avena says, "I say that habit's but a long practice, friend, and this becomes men's nature in the end." We have now stated what continence, incontinence, endurance, and softness are, and how these states are related to each other. 11. The study of pleasure and pain belongs to the province of the political philosopher, for he is the architect of the end, with a view to which we call one thing bad and another good without qualification. Further, it is one of our necessary tasks to consider them, for not only did we lay it down that moral virtue and vice are concerned with pains and pleasures, but most people say that happiness involves pleasure. This is why the blessed man is called by a name derived from a word meaning enjoyment. Now first, some people think that no pleasure is a good either in itself or incidentally, since the good and pleasure are not the same. Second, others think that some pleasures are good but that most are bad. Third, again there is a third view, that even if all pleasures are good, yet the best thing in the world cannot be pleasure. First, the reasons given for the view that pleasure is not a good at all are A, that every pleasure is a perceptible process to a natural state, and that no process is of the same kind as its end, e.g., no process of building of the same kind as a house. B, a temperate man avoids pleasures. C, a man of practical wisdom pursues what is free from pain, not what is pleasant. D, the pleasures are a hindrance to thought, and the more so, the more one delights in them, e.g., in sexual pleasure. For no one could think of anything while absorbed in this. E, there is no art of pleasure, but every good is the product of some art. F, children and the brutes pursue pleasures. Second, the reasons for the view that not all pleasures are good are that A, there are pleasures that are actually base and objects of reproach, and B, there are harmful pleasures, for some pleasant things are unhealthy. Third, the reason for the view that the best thing in the world is not pleasure is that pleasure is not an end, but a process. 12. These are pretty much the things that are said. That it does not follow from these grounds that pleasure is not a good, or even the chief good, is plain from the following considerations. A. First, since that which is good may be so in either of two senses, one thing good simply, and another good for a particular person, natural constitutions and states of being, and therefore also the corresponding movements and processes, will be correspondingly divisible. Of those which are thought to be bad, some will be bad if taken without qualification, but not bad for a particular person, but worthy of his choice, and some will not be worthy of choice, even for a particular person, but only at a particular time and for a short period, though not without qualification. While others are not even pleasures, but seem to be so, viz., all those which involve pain and whose end is curative, e.g., the processes that go on in sick persons. B. Further, one kind of good being activity and another being state, the processes that restore us to our natural state are only incidentally pleasant. For that matter, the activity at work in the appetites for them is the activity of so much of our state and nature as has remained unimpaired. For there are actually pleasures that involve no pain or appetite, e.g. those of contemplation. The nature in such a case not being defective at all. That the others are incidental is indicated by the fact that men do not enjoy the same pleasant objects when their nature is in its settled state as they do when it is being replenished. But in the former case, they enjoy the things that are pleasant without qualification. In the latter, the contraries of these as well. For then they enjoy even sharp and bitter things, none of which is pleasant either by nature or without qualification. The states they produce, therefore, are not pleasures naturally or without qualification. For as pleasant things differ, so do the pleasures arising from them. C. Again, it is not necessary that there should be something else better than pleasure, as some say the end is better than the process, for pleasures are not processes, nor do they all involve process. They are activities and ends. Nor do they arise when we are becoming something, but when we are exercising some faculty. And not all pleasures have an end different from themselves, but only the pleasures of persons who are being led to the perfecting of their nature. This is why it is not right to say that pleasure is perceptible process, but it should rather be called activity of the natural state, and instead of perceptible, unimpeded. It is thought by some people to be process just because they think it is in the strict sense good, for they think that activity is process, which it is not. B. The view that pleasures are bad because some pleasant things are unhealthy is like saying that healthy things are bad because some healthy things are bad for money-making. Both are bad in the respect mentioned, but they are not bad for that reason. Indeed, thinking itself is sometimes injurious to health. Neither practical wisdom nor any state of being is impeded by the pleasure arising from it. It is foreign pleasures that impede. For the pleasures arising from thinking and learning will make us think and learn all the more. C. The fact that no pleasure is the product of any art arises naturally enough. There is no art of any other activity either, but only of the corresponding faculty. Though, for that matter, the arts of the perfumer and the cook are thought to be arts of pleasure. D. The arguments based on the grounds that the temperate man avoids pleasure, and that the man of practical wisdom pursues the painless life, and that children and the brutes pursue pleasure, are all refuted by the same consideration. We have pointed out in what sense pleasures are good without qualification, and in what sense some are not good. Now both the brutes and children pursue pleasures of the latter kind, and the man of practical wisdom pursues tranquil freedom from that kind, viz., those which imply appetite and pain, i.e., the bodily pleasures. For it is these that are of this nature, and the excesses of them, in respect of which the self-indulgent man is self-indulgent. This is why the temperate man avoids these pleasures, for even he has pleasures of his own. 13. But further, E. It is agreed that pain is bad and to be avoided, for some pain is without qualification bad, and other pain is bad because it is in some respect an impediment to us. Now the contrary of that which is to be avoided, qua something to be avoided and bad, is good. Pleasure, then, is necessarily a good. For the answer of Susippus, that pleasure is contrary both to pain and to good, as the greater is contrary both to the less and to the equal, is not successful. Since he would not say that pleasure is essentially just a species of evil. And F. If certain pleasures are bad, that does not prevent the chief good from being some pleasure, just as the chief good may be some form of knowledge, though certain kinds of knowledge are bad. Perhaps it is even necessary, if each disposition has unimpeded activities, that whether the activity, if unimpeded, of all our dispositions, or that of some one of them, is happiness, this should be the thing most worthy of our choice, and this activity is pleasure. Thus the chief good would be some pleasure, though most pleasures might perhaps be bad without qualification. And for this reason, all men think that the happy life is pleasant, and weave pleasure into their ideal of happiness, and reasonably too, for no activity is perfect when it is impeded, and happiness is a perfect thing. This is why the happy man needs the goods of the body and external goods, i.e. those of fortune, viz., in order that he may not be impeded in these ways. Those who say that the victim on the rack or the man who falls into great misfortunes is happy if he is good are, whether they mean to or not, talking nonsense. Now, because we need fortune, as well as other things, some people think good fortune the same thing as happiness. But it is not that, for even good fortune itself, when in excess, is an impediment, and perhaps should then be no longer called good fortune, for its limit is fixed by reference to happiness. And indeed the fact that all things, both brutes and men, pursue pleasure is an indication of its being somehow the chief good. No voice is wholly lost that many peoples, but since no one nature or state either is or is thought the best for all, neither do all pursue the same pleasure, yet all pursue pleasure. And perhaps they actually pursue not the pleasure they think they pursue, nor that which they would say they pursue, but the same pleasure, for all things have by nature something divine in them. But the bodily pleasures have appropriated the name both because we oftenest steer our course for them, and because all men share in them. Thus, because they alone are familiar, men think there are no others. It is evident also that if pleasure, i.e. the activity of our faculties, is not a good, it will not be the case that the happy man lives a pleasant life. For to what end should he need pleasure, if it is not a good, but the happy man may even live a painful life? For pain is neither an evil nor a good, if pleasure is not. Why then should he avoid it? Therefore, too, the life of the good man will not be pleasanter than that of anyone else, if his activities are not more pleasant. 14. G. With regard to the bodily pleasures, those who say that some pleasures are very much to be chosen, viz., the noble pleasures, but not the bodily pleasures, i.e., those with which the self-indulgent man is concerned, must consider why, then, the contrary pains are bad. For the contrary of bad is good. Are the necessary pleasures good in the sense in which even that which is not bad is good? Or are they good up to a point? Is it that where you have states and processes of which there cannot be too much, there cannot be too much of the corresponding pleasure, and that where there can be too much of the one, there can be too much of the other also? Now there can be too much of bodily goods, and the bad man